Today's talk is given by Gary Gale, Director of Web and Community at Nokia Location and Commerce. His talk is entitled "Of Digital Stuff and Making Your Location History on the Interwebs." Gary is a self-professed geek with a life and has a wealth of experience of making technology do useful things. His love affair with maps began with discovering the Harry Beck map of the London Underground, a key theme of our previous seminar. And based in southwest London, Gary actually works for Nokia in London, Berlin, primarily, which of course gives him not one but two undergrounds to worry about each day. Before joining Nokia, Gary led Yahoo's Geotechnologies group in the UK. Gary's also co-founder of WearCamp EU, the Geo Unconference for Europe, chair of AGI W3G, and sits on the W3C Points of Interest Working Group and the UK Location User Group. Gary's regularly in demand as a speaker and presenter at a variety of conferences and also regularly writes blogs and tweets. He therefore is perfectly poised to tell us all about the exciting world of today's geo industry and perhaps, if we're lucky, touching on competition from Google and a certain fruit. Over to Gary.
Thanks, Harry. I like that. This is probably the most civilised way of doing things. Normally in talks, you have to suffer the penance of listening to somebody speak at you and give you death by PowerPoint for 45 minutes before they give you a drink. And you never, ever give speakers drinks. this is great. Anyway, thanks to Owen for viciously plagiarising everything which is supposed to be on this first slide. So I'm not going to read it to you because you've heard it all before. Now, onto the interweb stuff. There's a lot of URLs in this talk, and there normally is in the talks that I do. I quite often see people sitting there tapping away furiously at mobiles. Can you go back to the previous slide, please? Because I didn't quite get the 147 character URL that you've just got up on screen. That's the only one that you need. An uppercase I and a zero on the end, by the way. As soon as Script finishes processing the PDF of this, that's the URL that you will find my slide deck and all the notes and all the links and other stuff. I get the feeling that Script has had one of his data centers knocked out by Hurricane Sandy, so it might be a few days, but don't go there right now, Civil 404. Anyway, this is not a talk about GIS. This isn't really even a talk about GI or geographical information or whatever acronym you want to put on it. Actually, this isn't the talk that I sat down to write when Owen dropped me an email. That talk was going to be about this, about how within the consumer mapping industry, we kind of find ourselves in the middle of a map war. So there's Nokia and Navtec, there's TomTom and TeleAtlas, there's Google, and a certain fruit battling itself out for overall map supremacy. But if you've been in the map industry for any period of time, you'll know that when your competitors cock up, and cock up they do, it's a case of but for the grace of God go I, and it's only going to be a short number of weeks, months, or days before you cock up. So this whole thing of pointing fun and saying, ha-ha, look at the funny guys in California who think they can make maps because it's so easy, that kind of reads of sharpen for you. So I didn't. Instead, I started to think about another theme, and I was in the middle of thinking about that theme when something happened. Now, a while back, I'd written another talk about digital history. It was called Big Data versus My Data. And I gave it at two conferences, one in the UK and one in Amsterdam, on the same day. Fairly safe and secure that I would be the only lunatic running from one conference centre to an airport, jumping on a plane, jumping in a cab, going to another conference centre and giving that talk. Now, the talk seemed to go down well. Nobody threw anything and nobody wrote anything nasty on Twitter, which is always gratifying. So, I filed the talk away, did my traditional blog pose, put slides in the notes out, and that's the topic done. Except it wasn't. A guy called Eric Van Rees, who is the editor of Geoinformatics magazine, he got in touch and said, that's a nice blog post, that would make a really good magazine article. So if you wouldn't mind taking 75 slides, 3,500 words, and roughly 45 minutes talking time, and just condensing it down into 750 words with no graphics whatsoever, and could we have that by the end of the week, that would be really nice, thank you. Well, ever up for a challenge? I did it, and it seemed to go down well, and nobody threw anything, and nobody wrote anything nasty on Twitter, which was also gratifying. So obviously, that's the topic, done and dusted. Except it wasn't. It ended up spawning one of those long, rambling conversations that you get on a certain 140-character maximum social network with Stephen Feldman, who used to be the chair of the AGI's Geo Community Conference and is now doing lots of stuff with OSMGB, taking the utterly contrarian stance that merely because I mentioned the word foursquare, it's something to disagree with. And it's one of the few reasons I remain on foursquare, because it really pisses Stephen off. So a lot of people agree with what I was saying. I know I haven't said what it is that I'm saying, but just trust me. But Stephen didn't. So I went back and I looked at this topic and discovered that in the conversations that I'd been having, maybe it really wasn't finished. Now hopefully this is the final definitive version, but I do reserve the right to be ecologically friendly and recycle this talk again at some point in time. Okay, so this is a talk that goes off in lots of different directions, but fundamentally it's about these two sets of geographical coordinates. Now, you should all recognise these as lat longs. Please nod.
Good.
Now, I've worked with some frightening, scary people who could look at those and tell you what country they come from. I've also worked with some incredibly frighteningly scary people who could not only tell you which country they come from, but who can also tell you what city in what country they come from, which is normally proof that geographers need to be let out and go out of it. But I'm not going to do that to you. There's no involuntary audience participation here. The first coordinate is near where I live, not too far away from the home of British rugby in Twickenham Stadium. The second coordinate will probably come as no surprise, and it's as close as I could get to this room. So, why this talk is about two sets of coordinates and a few other coordinates besides will, I hope, become clear. Now, one of the things I do like about writing talks is the fact that inevitably a conference organiser or a seminar organiser says to me, we'd like to come and give a talk. And I say, that's absolutely wonderful. Thank you very much. And they say, can we have a talk title and an abstract? So I think of something and I give it to them. And this is normally about 3 to 4 months before it happens. And over that period of time, chances of the talk and the abstract bearing any resemblance to what it is I've said are probably 0.01%. But there's themes behind these talks which keep on coming out. Now, if you're old enough to remember Sesame Street, and I am old enough to remember Sesame Street, each program used to say, this program is brought to you by a certain letter and a certain number, because this was good, it was educational. I can see people nodding here. So, this talk is brought to you by this man. His name is Callan Elliot McCrea. I used to work with him at Flickr, which is Yahoo's photo sharing service, and he's now CEO of a company called Etsy, which is a marketplace for people to... careful with the beer, please. A marketplace for people to sell their handcrafted goods. Yeah, if you're in the market for something quite niche and quite cool and quite funky, go there, it's fantastic. My wife keeps Etsy in business alone in custom iPhone cases, that's what I got. So, it's brought to you by Kevin. It's also brought to you by this man, who, apart from having the most receding hairline in the history of the internet, his name is Aaron Stroud Cope. I also worked with him at Flickr, and after he left Flickr, he went and worked for Stamen Design, which is a cartographical design studio in San Francisco, where, in true San Franciscan fashion, his official job title was Chief Troublemaker. And he's now making trouble at the Smithsonian Institute on the other side of America, and thankfully hasn't been caught up in all of the Hurricane Sandy fun. And then there's my kids. No, really, these are my kids, and this isn't an excuse for me to put a picture of my family up and you all hopefully... There is reason behind my madness here. Okay. Now, before I get into anything regarding digital stuff, history, location, maybe even a map or two, I want to try and frame this with a bit of context. And I want to talk about how we communicate. Or to be more precise, the way in which we communicate. Now, hopefully you'll agree that as a species, we tend to be, you know, politics and warfare aside, pretty much social. We like communicating with each other. It's something we do an awfully large amount. Although the way in which we do it has changed a lot. A lot of our communication is both verbal and non-verbal. You know the old quote about, you know, communication is 99% non-verbal. It relies on face-to-face, person-to-person proximity, so that hopefully you can combine the verbal and non-verbal together and people will understand what it is that you mean. Although when I speak to some of my German colleagues, we do have these hysterical differences of opinion. They speak what we call Dinglish, which is this very odd German-English hybrid. But hopefully we're able to communicate what it is that we need to say. Some of our communication is written. The old-fashioned way, using pen and paper. And although I've seen a lot of commentators calling out the death of the letter, although these are the same commentators who make a living out of articles which start off the death of. To be fair, I can't actually remember the last time I actually had to sit down and write a letter. Fill out a form, yes, but write a letter, no. A lot of our communication is still verbal, but via a phone, be that that old-fashioned thing which they call a landline, or a mobile. And we call and we text, and especially if you're in the under 20 demographic, you text a hell of a lot. But, be it talking face-to-face, texting someone, writing an email, that intended audience is still narrow. Person-to-person or person-to-small audience. But then this thing called the internet came along, and then, I don't know, those of you who saw the opening ceremony of the Olympics, you could tell all the nerds going, "That's Tim Berners-Lee!" And all of the American commentators going, "Who's he?" Oh, he invented the internet. No, he didn't. He invented the World Wide Web, but let's not get into that. The combination of the internet and the World Wide Web, we frequently, within my industry, contract to the interwebs because it sounds vaguely cool. Anyway, the interwebs have added to all of this. And now we broadcast thoughts, feelings, experiences out to the world, regardless of whether we think anyone will see it, regardless of whether we think anyone's going to listen, empathise, or even communicate back. These things are called social networks. We still talk, we still meet, we still engage, and we still sometimes, if people are mad enough to let us, broadcast like I'm doing to you right now. But the human-to-human communication has been augmented, maybe complemented, by electronic communications. We're as likely to put a post up on Twitter, a status on Facebook or Google+, or any other of the geosocial networks that exist, as we are to speak face-to-face. And indeed, these are responsible for keeping a lot of communications going between the geographically dispersed friends and family that we find ourselves with these days, than writing the letter and putting the airmail stamp on it and popping it in the post box. Ah, good. Now, because this type of communication is electronic, it means it generates data as it goes. And today, we generate a lot of data. Big data. And we do it on a daily basis. And seeing as I can see some people with phones, it's probably not unfair to say that there's big data being generated in this room at this very precise moment. And we all seem to be doing this, although maybe all is a sweeping overgeneralisation, because my mother sure as heck doesn't. But enough of us are making digital stuff for it to start to make an impact, and for it to matter, for it to start to be significant. Now, some of this data is implicit. It's a byproduct of what we do. That gentleman down there with his phone is talking to the cellular network. In order for the cellular network to work, it's got to know where his phone is so that it can get signals back and forwards. That's implicit data. It's not a privacy invasion, by the way, I hasten to add, that's a whole different topic. It's just the way in which today's mobile networks work. But our smartphones, our tablets, our laptops, our GPS systems, the sat-navs that we have in our car, which we never ever pay subscriptions to get the CD in the post to update, all of these things generate implicit data. It's a byproduct of the life we find ourselves living. And this is, the cell tower fix trail from a guy who spends his time driving around California. And considering it's pretty much going up one freeway, it's interesting to see quite how inaccurate some of these readings can be. But I digress. However, a lot of the data is not implicit, it's explicit. We type out the status update on our phone, our tablet, our laptop. We tap or we click on a button that says go, it says submit. We take a photo, we maybe do one of those nice image filters that things like Instagram do, and we click share or we click upload. Hey presto, instant explicit data. Hey presto, instant big data. And by doing this, we're explicitly communicating, explicitly broadcasting, explicitly sharing with friends, with family, and with the interwebs in general. We all play our part in generating ever more and more volumes of big data. And generate it, we do. Lots of it. Yeah, it's called big data because that's one of these nice buzzwordy phrases that this industry uses. But I think massive data would be a more accurate definition of it. And while our own individual contribution to it may not be that big in the grand scheme of things, when you put it together, it's the start of an ever-growing corpus of data. And there's companies which will provide the means for us to broadcast this and share it, as well as hopefully providing a means of revenue for them so that we can keep doing all of this. And the amount that gets generated every day, it's almost too big for us to think and to comprehend like Eddie Izzard said. Yeah. We know it's a big number, but it's a big number that we can't actually kind of get our head around. I mean, we vaguely understand what a megabyte is because that's roughly one of those old 3.5-inch floppies. We know that our laptops normally hold gigabytes of disk drives. And we know there's things called petabytes and terabytes, but beyond that, it's big. So, let's look at a sample of what gets generated on a daily basis. Communication, sharing, broadcasting from some of the services which I use. So, I tweet, update my Facebook status, round about once a day, probably about 20 times a day, to be accurate. I check in on Foursquare, probably around 10 times a day, taking up both photos to Instagram, Flickr, Facebook, maybe 3 times a week. Now, that's just my contribution. As you can see behind me, there's a lot of people doing this, and that's... it's a shitload of data. So, here's a specific example of why this is big. So, I post a single tweet on Twitter. It weighs in at around about 72 characters, including spaces and punctuation. So that's just over half of Twitter's 140 character limit. The tweet is assigned a unique identifier. One of these magically increasing numbers. That identifier gets applied into a URL, which is going to probably last for the duration of Twitter's lifetime, and because I geotagged the tweet, Twitter's helpfully added that, and it's said at what time I did it, and it's attached a photo and some account information. A little bit more metadata than the 72 characters. So, because I'm a geek and because I know these things, I know that if I take that particular identifier and I stick it on the end of that URL into Twitter's API and do some magic OAuth credential wrangling, it will give me back Twitter's view of what that tweet is. And out of those 72 characters of tweet comes back 115 lines of JSON. JavaScript object notation format data. It is too big to fit on one slide. If I wanted to fit the entirety of it on one slide, the point size would be sort of minus 12. So that, but in addition to that, I can tell you there's metadata about the tweet. There's information on my account, my name, my account's unique ID, my general location, my biography, all the stuff that's in my Twitter profile, is how many tweets I've posted, which I think is 14,811 at the time I took this snapshot, how many followers I have, how many favorites I've flagged, how many Twitter lists I have, how many Twitter lists I appear in. There's details of my profile on Twitter's website, the HTML colors of my profile page, the profile image, the background. And because I've geotagged it, there's also the full geographic information about where I was, including the bounding box of the locality. That's how big data gets its name. 72 characters of tweet and a tap begets 115 lines of JSON and a shedload of data. Okay. How long is all of this going to go on? This is where the people I spoke about right at the beginning, those people on the slides, this is where they start to come into the story. So, remember when you were kids? And I'm really jealous because for some of you that wasn't that long ago. Anyway, my children are kids. And as far as they're concerned, the summer holidays are endless. The sky is always blue. Mum, dad, big brother and big sister, grandparents, aunts and uncles, they are eternal. They are static. Nothing is ever going to change. Remember that? Even though you grew up in the UK, where the summers aren't always endless and the sky isn't always blue, and most of the time when you go away on holiday in this country it pisses down with rain, it's still eternal blue, endless summer holidays. But then the inevitable happens, and we grow up, and we get allowed legally to drink this stuff, and we discover the hard way summer wasn't endless, and that almost everything there is finite. And geosocial networks, they're not finite either. Remember Gowalla? Anybody here remember Gowalla? It was one person. It was kind of like Foursquare, only not as much fun. Nobody could ever explain to me what Gowalla was for, apart from the fact that I went to a place with a mobile phone, I said check in, and I got to pick up these strange digital tokens, like a watering can, or a half-eaten hamburger, which they could then go and leave somewhere else for someone else to pick up. Nobody knew what this meant. Nobody knew what it did. Not even the founders of Gowalla, who turned up at a conference. And over beers, I said, yeah, really nice app, really lovely, glossy UI. What does it mean? And he looked frantic and tried to escape. So, social networks, geosocial networks, they're not eternal. They're born, if they get lucky, they grow, they get users, they get funding, and then at some time or other, they stop. And Gowalla found out the hard way, Twitter will probably find out the hard way, Facebook will probably find out the hard way at some point in time. Remember 5 years ago, there was MySpace, and it was unassailable, and now it just looks like someone has gone berserk with Microsoft homepage creator version 1.0 space. Into web. Yeah. You remember the first websites that you used to see? They weren't these slick, glorious Ajax-y things. It was like, hello, my name's Timmy, and here's a picture of my pet cat with a purple background and pink lettering. Now, oh, and don't forget scrolling marquee along the bottom. That's always a favourite at the moment. So, anyway, if it's a social network that you don't use much, which dies, doesn't really bother us. It generates a bit of column inches. A few commentators go, ha ha ha, told you so, and jobs are good. But if it is a social network that you have shared an awfully large amount of data with, what happens next? Well, a lot of people, myself included, immediately go into what I characterise as, I want my data back, mode. But it's your data, you can have it back. Of course it's your data, you made it. You composed that witty 140 character pithy tweet. You shared that link. You took the photo, you were at that place when you checked in. Of course it's your data. But, there's a point to be made here. You might have created it. You may own the data, but the copy of the data that you shared with that social network into this nebulous thing called the cloud, it's just that. It's a copy. It's not necessarily yours anymore. And because most of us tend not to preserve or back up all the wonderful content that we create on its way to the interwebs, it's often the only copy of it. You may have created it, but the copy up there on the servers in the cloud, that's not necessarily yours. Now, to be honest, it's an easy mistake to make. Has anybody come across this hashtag on Twitter? It's nothing to do with AIM, by the way. It stands for I am not a lawyer. And it's normally what people put up there when they are giving an opinion which could be construed as being legally binding, and they hastily prefix this, saying, I'm not a lawyer, but here's my opinion. Now, I may be a geotechnologist, many more things beside, I am definitely not a lawyer. And are there any lawyers in the room? No, okay, good, you aren't either. And, actually, by the way, there is a social network for lawyers. it's called DeFero Law. And you have to put your certificate of incorporation number in before it will let you register, so that any advice that you may give on this social network won't be construed as being... Anyway, so, I digress. None of us read the small print, do we? How many of us sign up and say, and you get presented with this wonderful legalese, and you go scroll, 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 where's the checkbox, where's the checkbox, click, accept, get me to the good stuff. But buried within all of this legalese, there's phrases that if you do read them, we see things like, you retain your rights. Another favourite is, you own the content you posted. And you always own your information. It all sounds really comfortably and non-threatening, doesn't it? It's great, it's my data, I own it, look. And immediately the subtleties and complexities of data ownership, data licensing, data copyright, the notions of intellectual property, fling them over your shoulder, cast them aside. We say to ourselves, it's my data down there and I want it. And it's this belief that we really are lawyers in our spare time that makes people think that somehow the data they shared via a certain geosocial network is physically theirs rather than the bit-for-bit perfect copy that they've licensed to that network. We forget for a minute that we're using our geosocial networks as a cloud backup, in some cases the only backup. And people like Michael Arrington, who founded TechCrunch and who really should know better, starts muttering darkly about being a data hostage. This was him complaining that he didn't want to pay Flickr $25 anymore, and Flickr was holding my data hostage. You won't give me my photos back, damn it, unless I pay you another $25. Now, the blunt and often harsh reality in all of this is the age-old adage that your parents probably told you when you first started to leave home, you get what you pay for. If you pay, you're probably a customer. If you get something for free, and I'll do what the marketeers did here, free, you can see those inverted commas, can't you? And they're in very large italics. You are probably, unknowingly or unwittingly, the product. You're not a customer, you're the product. Seems harsh, but actually it's fair. It's our content that keeps the geosocial networks going. It's our content that they try to monetize and that hopefully allows them to keep the servers running and to keep the disk storage going, unless they happen to be in a data center in New York at this precise moment in time. By the way, who builds data centers in the middle of a metropolitan area in basements? Apparently you do in New York, and they're all flooded at the moment, but that's beside the point. Now, you might have seen the previous slide with Michael Arrington from TechCrunch, and thinking, ha ha, I know these things. Look, Flickr Pro may be chargeable, but if my subscription lapses, I can't get my photos back. Oh no, this is terrible. And that was actually true. I'll show you in a few moments, but bear with me. So, let's forget big data at the moment and think about your data. Actually, no, let's think about my data. As of about a month ago, my geosocial footprint looks something like this. Facebook's numbers would be up there, and I'll get to the reason why they're not in it. Now, in the grand scheme of things, in all the massive numbers I've thrown around, which have got millions and thousands after them, it's a drop in the ocean. But I created this stuff, and it is important to me. Very important to me. And yes, I know I'm a geek, and yes, I know I'm very nerdy, but it's still important to me. The reason it is important to me is, as Aaron, remember him from the slides with the hairline? Yeah, okay. Anything you do for a significant amount of time becomes part of your history. And that's my history, which I put into the internet. Now, as I might have mentioned before, I'm a bit of a geo-nerd. And almost, and you'll notice I'm talking about geosocial networks rather than social networks, because I like stuff which includes coordinates. I like stuff which includes geotags, because I like to make maps of things that I've done. Okay, I'm not particularly a massive demographic here. Hopefully you might like making maps as well. But I'd like to see where I was when I composed a particular tweet. It puts it into context for me. I want to see where I took some of my best photos. I want to see where those photos were taken. Now, some of this mappiness already exists in some of these big data stores. So Instagram, for example, recently rolled out a feature where I can see a nice map with all of my photos. But not everything does. So I kind of may need to get that data in order to do the stuff that I want to do. And remember, 99% of your geosocial networks, I'm not the customer. I am contributing to the product. So, how do my regularly used networks cope here? Regardless of whether I own the data that I put up there or not, how easy is it for me to get a copy back? In case they go titsup.com, or in case I just don't want to use them anymore and I just want my data. So, let's take the consumer-friendly version. The one-click download. Can I go to a particular page on a particular website and click the big friendly button which says, give me a content of my data, and then watch my browser start to download this? Doesn't matter what format it's in, can I do that? Well, funnily enough, Facebook is actually the only one that allows this. Well, it kind of, sort of allows it now. I'm sure I used to be able to do this. Certainly, I can still request a download of the information, but when I tried this out last week, it'll only give me what I've put back in since Facebook rolled out Timeline. If I know the magic identifiers, I can still do some clever API stuff, but I've got to know the magic identifiers before I can do the API stuff. So basically, the first 2 years of my Facebook history is dead. I cannot get to it. I can still get all the photos that I posted since 2008 when I first started using Facebook. But I can't get everything. So rather than say this doesn't work, let's just file this under needs further investigation and move on. Now sometimes this lack of a one-button download is a deliberate decision on the part of a given company. Sometimes it's the hope that if they release an API, some enterprising developer will come along and do this, and there's been figures published that show that when you get a product, if you release an API to it, you increase use of it because developers do crazy, cool, funky stuff. But sometimes that doesn't always happen, and there still isn't a one-button download from Flickr at the moment. So, talking of APIs, application programming interfaces, a very nice 1970s phrase, surely all of the remaining geosocial networks will have an API that will let me knock up a little bit of code to get my data contributions. Sure. Well, not everybody does. You know, an API tends to come after the launch and after it's become successful, and if it does come at all, it doesn't often let me do what I want to do. Thankfully, all the API networks I use, with one notable exception, provides an API and lets me use that API to get my data. All of my data. This is a good thing, and it meets the requirements for an API to do what Kellen calls minimal competence. And when he coined this phrase a few years back, he said, minimal competence is the ability to get in and to get out what you put in. All of it. In high fidelity, in a reasonable amount of time. The bare minimum people need to be building, the bare minimum that people need to be using, and absolutely the bare minimum you should build in tools and encourage people who are not builders, builders here meaning programmers, to use. That's the bare, that's your foundation level. Everything else is fine. But that's the minimal thing that you should be doing if you're going to build a product and service and an API. Probably come as no surprise to say to hear that Kellen designed Flickr's API, and Flickr's API expresses those sentiments admirably. Twitter doesn't. It fails the minimal competence test. You have to look really, really deep in their API documentation, into the really boring small print stuff which almost looks like legalese, to find the justification for this. And it says, clients may access a theoretical maximum of 3,200 statuses. Well, hold on a second, I put more than that in there. And then, by the way, you also find that within that 3,200, it's not the stuff that you've created, it's also the stuff that people have interacted with. So any replies to that, any retweets, any favourites. To ensure performance of the site, this is where it starts to get into dubious territory, this artificial limit is temporarily in place. Well, it's been temporarily in place since Twitter launched. And I will leave it as an exercise to you what I think of this as a justification for not giving people their data back. You know, let's be honest. If somebody downloading a small amount, a relatively small amount of data off of their service is going to cause them to bring their service down to its knees, they've got bigger problems than not giving people their data. The sad truth is, when it comes to our own data, there's not always a willingness to make this easy. If it's even on the radar at all. And this chap, Aaron Zinn, he's the guy behind the Internet Archive, also known as the Wayback Machine. And this is a project which is run between the Smithsonian Institute and the US Library of Congress, and basically they're archiving the internet. They have got more storage capacity than you can ever imagine. Every day they generate tens of thousands of petabytes of data, and you can actually go onto the Wayback Machine and you can see your earliest efforts producing your website, and then you discover that you really were teaming with your picture of your pet cat and the scrolling marquee and the pink text on the purple background, and you can just go, oh god, that's so awful. So, they're archiving the internet. So maybe if we can't always get our data back, maybe the solution is to keep an archive of it before it goes in. Or maybe keep that archive as up to date as you possibly can. A personal digital archive. There's actually the acronym PDA is now officially in use to stand for personal digital acronym, not the small palm pilots we used to be going around about 10 years ago with the handwriting recognition that really didn't quite work. It was about as reliable as Siri is in translating text messages from speech into text on your iPhone. And try doing Siri to send a text when you're drunk. It's hysterical. Thanks to the web APIs that we have available now, and another social network, admittedly one for people who know how to code, a lot of this is already possible. And the scope, range, and functionality of what you can do is growing by the day. The irony, by the way, that I could build a personal digital archive out of code found on another social network which is built around a source code archival system is not lost on me. Please smile. That was, okay, done. So, I have my own Instagram. And no, I'm not going to share the URL here. But, because the idea is it's mine, it's all the photos I take, it's not a clone of the social network. But if you go to GitHub, you can find something called Parallelogram. You can download it, you can configure it, you can run it. It's open source, free. All you need is some web space, the ability to run a little bit of PHP and a little bit of MySQL database. There's even a config file which you fill out with your details. Hey presto, it will instantly start sucking down as many times a day as you want anything you put onto Instagram. And it actually does one thing better than Instagram, because I don't know if you've seen, you know, people post photos via Instagram to social networks, and you click on it, and it takes you to the photo and says, this photo was taken by Gary. And so you click on that, and it says, please see this on our mobile app. And it's like, well, I'm on my laptop. No, you've got to use the mobile app. No, but I'm on my laptop. No, you've got to use the mobile app. I don't want to use the mobile app. I'm on my laptop. Instagram won't let you do that. They want you to use the mobile app. This allows you to just have a series of web pages with all of the stuff that you've ever done, which actually is an improvement on the original. And it's free. And it works as well on my phone as it does on my laptop, showing me exactly what I've uploaded. And as I said, it goes one step further. It gives me the missing profile page and the missing web page that Instagram won't give me. There's also my own personal archive of Foursquare. It's also on GitHub, and it's called Private Square. Like Parallelogram, Private Square quietly uses the Foursquare API to go back to my very, very first check-in, and twice a day it quietly syncs and slurps it down and sticks it in a database. I can look at maps of where I've checked in. I can choose the map provider I want to use. So in this case, this is OpenStreetMap data and one of Stamen's dot spotting map templates on top of it. It works as well on my laptop as it does on my mobile. It uses the geolocation stuff built into modern-day mobiles and modern-day laptops. And here's the nice thing. I don't even have to share with Foursquare. I can just do this absolutely privately. So, yeah, maybe if I'm checking into somewhere where I don't want people to know about, and I'm not talking about the STD clinic, I'm talking about maybe if I'm going for a job and I don't necessarily want my boss to know that I'm in the competitor's office, I can do that. And I can do much more with this than I can with Foursquare. Foursquare really allows you to say, I'm here. They've changed the rules a bit. I mean, I don't remember when Foursquare first came out. There was one guy who, in the space of an hour, managed to check in at the North Pole, the South Pole, the mouth of the Amazon River, and the Great Pyramid. Now, that's some travelling. But now Foursquare geofences you, and it says, oh, no, you're a bit far away from that. But you still have to be there. Private Square, you can not only say, I am here, you can say, I will be there. You can say, I was there. You can even say, I want to go there again, because it's so good. It even, and I think this is quite cute, it even adds the weather. Now, my photos also end up on Flickr, and quite why I decided to take a photo of a small plastic lizard sitting on my mobile phone is utterly beyond me, but there is a private archive of Flickr as well. And it will come as no surprise by the naming convention that seems to have been adopted that this one is called Parallel Flickr. It also lives on GitHub, and all the same stuff that I've said applies. So, I've got my own archives of Instagram. I've got my own archives of Flickr. I've got my own archives of Foursquare. I sort of have my archives of Facebook. But what about Twitter? Well, until Twitter decides that their site is stable enough to allow me to grab the 14,500 odd tweets, unfortunately, the next best solution is RSS, believe it or not. Google, handily, never throws anything away from an RSS feed. So if you find the magic RSS URL, which is your Twitter profile, and you stick it in Google Reader, it will quite happily start archiving this for you, and it will never throw it away. Now, I found this out a long time ago, and I got about 99% of my tweets. All I need to do now at some point is write some code to get them out of Google Reader, and again, that's filed up as something I need to do when I actually get some time to do it. But you can do it, and it's a start, and it's preserving it. It's not necessarily under my control. Google could any time decide to change that functionality, but for now, it's good enough. Now, you might also have noticed the links in my slides look kind of like bit.ly links, but they're on a domain called vtmy.org. That's because I've also been archiving my short links, because I'm slightly anal where this is concerned. And again, self-hosted a nice little free thing called URLs, which is a horrible way of pronouncing it, but you can have your own links. So when link shorteners shut down, which they do, or when they suffer a catastrophic outage like Owlbee did about 3 years ago, and they, because they thought offsite backups were for wimps, they lost 3 years of short links. And so many pages of the web went dark because the short link just didn't resolve it. So I forgot to mention that. So, my big data, my personal online history, it's important to me. Yours might be important to you. We're often told that we can't have our own cake and eat it. But with this growing beginnings of the notion of a personal digital archive, and thanks to the enterprising people who create web APIs, and then the even more enterprising people who build free stuff on those APIs, and put their code up for the world to download free of charge, maybe we can have our cake and eat it where this is concerned. Yeah. Your online history may not be that important in the grand scheme of things, unless you go on to be a great historical figure. I'm sorry to break this to you now, but most of us probably won't. But it is yours, and it is intensely personal. You name it. And when social networks go to the place where software goes to die, it might just be worth preserving that before the servers get powered off forever. You know, maybe the geeks will inherit the earth. Now, I've been going 53 minutes according to this, so I'm going to wrap this up. But I want to end with a somewhat cautionary tale, which highlights why I think this is important. So, a friend of a friend, called Claudio, received a phone call from a very nice constable at the British Transport Police, and said that there'd been an assault at Leicester Square tube station in central London. Now, this phone call came just before Christmas last year, and the alleged assault happened in June of that year. Somebody had been assaulted on the tube platforms, and that unfortunate individual had ended up with, in Charing Cross Hospital with broken ribs. The police said they had evidence that placed Claudio at that station at that time that the assault took place. Now, could he just tell them where he was and what he was doing that night, please? Now, I wonder how many of us could say with any degree of certainty where we were, what we were doing, and whether there was anybody who could corroborate this without some recourse to some form of aid memoir. I know I probably couldn't, and I certainly couldn't do it to the level that the nice gentleman in the police uniform is going to want. Just saying I was out on the piss with my mates probably won't cut it. Now, for Claudio, it was entirely feasible that he was at Leicester Square on the night of the assault. But when he thought about it, like most of us, worryingly, there were large gaps in his recollection. Yeah, it must have been a good night, basically. So he started mining his web history. He started mining the information that he was able to get to find out where it was and what he was doing. And thankfully, with the help of some tweets, some Facebook status updates which were geotagged, and also with geotagged photos, he was able to piece the entirety of the night together and go back to the nice gentleman in the blue uniform from the British Transport Police and say, yes, I was there, but this is what I was doing, and here are witnesses, and no, honestly, officer, I didn't do this. So as cliche goes, he was eliminated from the police's inquiries. But what I like about this little sort of anecdote is the location history and the big data element to it. Turns out the accusation was built on big data, because if you go around London much, you have one of these. It's called an Oyster card, and it automatically tops itself up, and you tap in and tap out to let you onto the buses and the trains and the tubes. Now, of course, all of these are sensors, and you generate a nice big data trail, and London Transport gets to know exactly where you were. And as it turns out, the guy who they subsequently found out actually did the assault tapped into Leicester Square tube station at exactly the same time as Claudio did, late on that December night. Therefore, a big data accusation, but also a defence and a corroboration and an alibi was also built on Claudio's big data and on the big data that his friends had generated. And, you know, once they managed to work this out and once they managed to pull the CCTV pictures, sure enough, there they saw Claudio tapping in at Leicester Square tube station and the guy who did the assault tapping in next to him. Now, I think that this is going to become a little bit more prevalent. The problem with big data stores is they're very, very socially attracted to each other. People like combining big data stores. Governments and law enforcement agencies love combining big data stores because they allow them to view the bigger picture. And maybe I'm being a bit doomsaying here, but I think the day is not coming that far off in the future where actually a lot of our daily life will be accompanied by not only generation of big data, but we're going to need to be able to get back at it. And so you don't have a computer says no moment where something happens, there's a glitch in the matrix, and all of a sudden you find yourself with a court summons or with a bill for a congestion charge where you weren't even in the country. And unless you've got a way of refusing it, then you turn up in court in a suit, or you end up having to pay that. Now, let's not leave it on too much of a gloom and doom note, but this is important, I think. It's going to become more important, and I think it's probably going to be important for you lot. So, Claudio's full story is at that URL, once Script gets itself sorted and actually uploads all of my slides and processes them, the one I said right at the beginning, that's where all of this meanderings and philosophical musings on big data and history will become. So, that's me. Thank you for listening, and thank you for not throwing anything, and cheers.
That's good. Right. Let's start. Questions? I think Tom was right in there first.
So, you talked about all these different websites that we enter data on, like Facebook, Twitter, Flickr, and you talked about GitHub, which you need to have a background of programming knowledge to kind of run properly.
Mm-hmm.
But like, my mum doesn't know how to program. So is there a call for one final product which amalgamates Flickr, Facebook, Twitter, that archives everything for everyone? Did you feel that that will be almost a final evolution?
I think that sort of thing will come. I think it will probably permanently be out of date as people struggle to keep up with the next cool thing that launches. But yes, I think that there will be something, and people will probably even end up paying for the comfort that it provides. And it will have that big, friendly, my mum can use it, click here button. So yes, and you're absolutely right that stuff on GitHub is normally not for the likes of my mum. You know, she wouldn't know an API if it came and bit her on the backside, bless her. But there again, she's in her mid-70s and prefers watching tennis on Sky Sports, so I don't expect her to. But this is early days, let's put it that way. And consider that really all of this stuff is normally built by enterprising developers who quite often aren't actually formally employed as developers. They just do it because the notion of open source and the notion of data just somehow appeals to them. A lot of this stuff you get businesses built out of. You only need to look at a certain Finnish hacker who posted something to a newsgroup many, many years ago saying, I've got this little thing, it's sort of like Unix, but I don't think it will go anywhere, but maybe people might want to use it. His name is Linus Torvalds, and that was the beginning of Linux. You know, these things have a beginning, and they do grow. So yes, I definitely think that will be coming. It's not here yet, but it will be coming.
Amazing, who's next?
You've talked about the stateless data that you generate for geotagging and its legal use and things, but is there not a huge problem with the accuracy of this data at the moment, especially the mobile generated stuff? Because for instance, I geotag myself here, half the time it says I'm in Leith, or in Jersey where I'm from, it says I'm somewhere in France.
Yeah.
It's not accurate yet, so the data will become outdated as soon as accuracy picks up.
That's extremely true. But if it's a case of having good enough based on what we have or not doing it at all, I would choose that one. I mean, you're absolutely right. The key driver for all of these services and for the information that they generate is two things. First of all, it's the growth of the smartphone. And secondly, it's the fact that GPS, or AGPS to be more precise, has now gone mainstream. And it's not without its problems. I mean, you try and use an AGPS-enabled smartphone in what they call an urban canyon. So in the city of London, in Barcelona, in Manhattan, it's not going to give you an accurate fix if it gives you a fix at all. But it's not just about the individual datums here. It's about the trends and the patterns. Overall, and if you want to look at individual items, you're probably going to look at stuff on either side. And if all of a sudden you see a geotag photo, for example, which says you're in Spain, where the two, an hour either side were taken, and it says you're in Edinburgh, then you're probably in Edinburgh. I agree that the accuracy that we really ideally want isn't there. GPS Plus, whenever it comes out, in whatever shape and form it comes out, will probably have solved some of those problems, but will come with its own set of problems. But it's still a case, I think, that at the moment it's good enough and it's better than nothing.
So the line here, can I take one back there?
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for the presentation.
It's
very informative and entertaining, which is a nice combination. My question is in relation to the fact that you were talking about a lot of information that's quote-unquote stored on the internet, that in essence, in your mind, you own versus the company that quote-unquote you've licensed it to.
Yeah.
My question is in relation to some of the potential changes in privacy and do not track with FTC and the e-privacy directive in the European Union, as far as not so much owning about the contents I place on the internet, but tracking my behavior, which may impact maps, as well as surfing. And just what your potential, I guess, I'm with the scope of your presentation, but I think directly related, what your thoughts are with regard to those implications associated with your words of caution, if you will, that you presented earlier.
Okay, so let's look at do not track first of all. Do not track governs predominantly the placement of tracking cookies within your web browser. And it governs something which is done under the hood without you necessarily knowing it. And the ability for advertisers to, in effect, pay for access to those cookies in order to serve you ads which they think is more relevant. With the act of composing a tweet or uploading a photo, that's a little bit different because it's something that you've initiated, and even though you may not fully realise the consequences of all of the machinations that go on behind it, it's still something you've done. There is a very, very fine line where you start to customise products and services according to location, and that fine line is a very careful edge between, hey, that's really neat and cool, and holy shit, how did they know that? And at the moment, due to the accuracy problems which were mentioned earlier, we're still at the very, very general stages of that. The elements of privacy that you get, again, these tends to at the moment be focused on what the courts have identified as PII, personally identifiable information. And it's an absolute mess. It's beyond a mess. It's fundamentally unbelievable. So on the one hand, you have some governments, Germany is a notable example of this, who are absolutely, totally focused on this. And you can't even store a full IP address in Germany, because the last octet of the IP address is considered to be personally identifiable information, so you have to obfuscate it. Compare and contrast that with a recent social engineering hack, which went on with a guy who had his MacBook, his iPhone, his iPad, and his Apple Mobile Me email all wiped out because somebody was able to phone up Apple's customer care center and say, I've lost my password, could you reset it for me, please? Send it to this email address. And Apple did it. The one thing that they asked for was your name, your email address, and the last four digits of your credit card, which you used to pay for your iTunes. The only problem was Amazon shows in the clear your name, your email address, and the last four digits of the credit card that you use on your Amazon account. Two companies taking shitloads of money from people, both with very different ideas of what constitutes personally identifiable information. So all this guy was needed to do, once he had the name and email address, plug it into a search engine, boom, there's the guy's wish list page on Amazon. Oh, look, four digits of his credit card. Hello, Apple Customer Care. Yes, I'm Fred Smith. Here's my email address and here's the last four digits of my card. I've been locked out of my account. Can you please send me a password reset email? But send it to this address because I can't log in at the moment. Okay, brilliant. Thank you very much. And the next thing this quite prominent Silicon Valley journalist found was his iPhone switched itself off, and when he booted it up again, it wiped everything. He worked out what was going on, ran to his laptop just to watch that do exactly the same, and because he was a bit of an Egypt, as my mother-in-law would say, he hadn't backed up any of his photos apart from on his laptop. He lost every single photo of his children from the age of, from the day that they were born up to 7 years old. Now that, yes, not backing those valuable memories up was a little bit stupid, but when you get into this realm of what constitutes personally identifiable information, everybody, every company has wildly differing views on what that does and doesn't constitute. We're going to have a Daily Mail moment for it to do this, because generally things don't get done, especially in this country, until they make the headlines of the Daily Mail. And once they do, an outrage of Tunbridge Wells reads about it over his Kellogg's Crunchy Nut Cornflakes in the morning, and then he starts ringing up and demands something gets done about this, damn it. But until that happens, as a nation, we kind of like, it doesn't really affect me. It's those crazy Americans.
Thank you very much.
Let's spin a little bit. Start the camera.
This is really two observations rather than questions from probably one of the least geekiest people in this entire room. The first is really an observation from my public sector colleagues, because I think we in Scotland are just getting our act together about all this crowdsourcing stuff and how public authorities can harvest this vast amount of data that citizens can provide. And what you raised was a note of caution in my mind, is that fine, if we start to rely on this for our databases, what happens when they want it back? You know, if they have a fallout with us. So I think an observation for us all is that we've really got to start to think about the policies and procedures, the agreements that we have with our citizen data providers. About that very thing.
Can I just comment on that for 1 second? If you're going to do that, you need a license agreement between you and the contributors. And if you do a license agreement which says We're going to take all of this data from you. Thank you very much. By the way, at some point in time, we'd like it back, please, and you have to give it. You have to give this back. You're probably going to find that the number of contributors you have at the square root of zero. The key point, I think, out of all of this is it's less about ownership. It's more about the ability to get hold of it and to keep it and maintain it. You could happily say to your citizen providers, thank you very much, we don't want to do this anymore. But there's a famous saying, and I don't know who it's attributed to, which is basically there is no delete button on the internet. Once it's out there, it's out there. If you put something out there which you think you might want back at some point in future, don't put it out there.
The second observation is slightly more worrying from my perspective, and I know 2 points don't make a trend, but Claudio's example is almost identical to my wife's example, where she was accused of leaving the scene of an accident in Manchester, and she had a formal letter from the police accusing her of that, and it was based on a misreading of automatic number plate registration. Right, but in both Claudio's case and in my wife's case, it always seemed as that the onus on us was to prove our innocence. Okay. Now, it used to be in British law that the onus was on the prosecution to prove you were guilty. And as you've observed, and as I have ranted in this room, you know, more than one occasion, that this, you call it big data, I think it's a very good word, that we are sleepwalking into something here that we don't quite comprehend, but when we wake up, it's going to be a very frightening society for us, and very, very different. So it's an observation, but I think your example was really, really good, and I think everybody in this room has to wake up to the implications of big data.
I would totally agree. I mean, I don't think we'll wake up one day into a very frightening society. I think we're in the middle of it right now. To be brutally honest, and I don't think we've had any privacy for probably the last 15 years. We just don't quite realise the scope and the scale of it. And you know, your example about misreading of an automatic number plate recognition system, I had exactly the same thing. I got a phone call from my wife when I was in California. Last year, saying, yeah, we just received a congestion charge fee because apparently you managed to hop on a plane, drive around central London without coming home and without telling me, and then hopped on the plane to go back. Either that or it was a mistake. And I rang Transport for London up and said, you know, I'm not in the country. It's a mistake. Well, no. Our records show that magic phrase which negates them of all responsibility. And so I said, so what do your records show? And they said, well, blue Subaru Impreza driving up St. Martin's Lane. I said, okay. And I don't want you to give me the full details of the number plate, but can you maybe give me a few hints? And they said, yes, it's GI04. And I said, right, first of all, mine isn't blue. It's silver, and secondly, that's not the first four digits of my number plate. And if you maybe like to go and talk to DVLA, they will confirm this. Oh no, you're gonna have to send me a photo. I'm not sending you a bloody photo. You go and do your own job. And we argued to and fro, and eventually they realised they weren't gonna get the photo out of me, and they spoke to DVLA. And hey presto, guess what? It wasn't me. They got it so totally wrong. But no, you're right. The onus has now gone on us, and I don't want to sound paranoid and think they're all out to get me. But I am, and they are. But you're right. Much more has now become like British libel law is, where the burden of proof is on the accused to prove they didn't libel, rather than the other way around. And it's the same with a lot of these automatically generated things. You know, there's the popular conception that if you put something into a computer, it can't possibly be wrong when it comes out the other side. And there's also the other perception, which is the one I subscribe to, which is if you put bullshit into a computer, you get bullshit out, but it's a special class of bullshit. It's really nice and shiny and people believe it, but fundamentally it's still bullshit.
There's two here, yourself.
So it's sort of on the same theme. I went a couple of days ago at Dynamic Earth, their Smart Cities event, a presentation from a company who will drill down, selling to local councils, drill down from payroll data, absence data, performance data, to your Facebook page, to your Twitter account, to what sports things were on the day that you were absent from work. And I think people don't realise what's happening. Now, I actually think the uses that were being sort of promulgated by this company are illegal in the UK, but they didn't seem to think so, and the councils they were selling them to didn't seem to think so. I think you're absolutely right, we're there already. And I don't believe there's a common understanding of what you can do from drilling down. Do you have any comments on where we're going and how it could be controlled if it can?
Yes, I've got three very individual comments on that, and you might be surprised to hear. Let me just find the applicable passage. Where are we? Ah, here we go. Okay, that is Twitter's legal page. Twitter Inc. is a limited liability company which is registered in the state of Delaware. The reason it's registered in the state of Delaware is Delaware has the lowest rate of corporation tax in the entirety of the United States. That is not Twitter Limited, that is not Twitter EU, that is not Twitter SARL based in Luxembourg for tax haven reasons. There is only one Twitter, and they are based in and registered in Delaware, even though their offices are in San Francisco. That's Instagram. Guess where they're registered? Delaware. That's Facebook. Guess where they're registered? Delaware. By using these services, you are under US law. To be particular, you are under the state legislature of the state of Delaware. So whether or not what this company was doing was illegal in the UK or not is utterly irrelevant, because it's not acting on data which is in the UK. It's not even acting on data which is stored on servers in the UK. It is acting on data whose use and promulgation is governed by the state of Delaware. So, in effect, we're all under US law the moment we use one of these. Whether or not it is illegal to use that data which has been garnered in the United Kingdom, that's another thing entirely. And I would probably say it's not, because there's already been rulings that basically what you put out there in the public, either explicitly on a blog or on a website or via a social network, it's not deemed to be a private conversation, it's deemed to be a public conversation, therefore you have no inherent rights to expect privacy over it. I do wonder whether or not it's sort of a little bit like a solution looking for a problem. You know, you read a lot of stuff in the tech media where somebody says, I don't know, social engineering scams have lost industry $37 gazillion over the last 2 months. And you think, oh, this is terrible, I must do something about this. Oh, look, the people who wrote this were for a company which sell me anti-social engineering software. No possible conflict of interest there at all. And, you know, in a lot of cases, it's kind of, these are solutions looking for problems. I would argue that it's probably a lot easier for a manager to say, Fred had the day off sick last night. Oh, look, it was the cup final yesterday. It's easier to do that than to pay hundreds of thousands of pounds in licensing fees for this service. It's like, do you remember the Rob My House website where people, it was queuing into people's central places and four-square check-ins to say when they were out. You could do that. Or you could just stand outside somebody's house and wait for them to go out, and that way you know they're no longer in there. Very low-tech approach to it, I'll admit. But it's probably easier to work out whose house to rob by watching it than it is to use a website which takes just one sense of it. So take these sort of things with a little bit of grain of salt to a certain degree. But, you know, it's hard to accept. But if you don't want this information out there, you probably shouldn't be putting it out there. But of course, that's hindsight, and hindsight's a wonderful gift.
But
that's a very interesting point you just made, and leading on from what Cameron said, you've kind of said in your talk, yes, it's really important to be aware of these sorts of privacy issues, and you don't want to be putting things out there. But on the other hand, you've said, well, actually, we need to be putting stuff out there so we can prove we weren't in a particular tube station at a particular time on a particular date.
There's the conundrum.
Indeed. So I think, yes, the audience, I'm starting to get more and more disturbed by what I'm hearing. And actually, linking up to your question, I went to a Distruct conference a number of years ago where some researchers, not at this university, did some very clever stuff with Twitter and Facebook APIs and drawing data out and analysing it with social segregation data and doing all sorts of clever stuff and coming out with this model. And they were really proud to announce the fact that they could work out how trustworthy you were, how likely you were to be a terrorist, what your sexuality was, all sorts of interesting things that were just horrifying the audience that was hearing that. But that data's out there, and actually, what do we do? Do we put our data out there to prove that we weren't in the tube station, or do we not put our data out there?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is very much a dual-edged sword. And on the one hand, you do have sort of recruitment agencies who will look for, I don't know, people posting photos of their bum on Facebook while when they were 16 while drunk. And that the inference is you wouldn't possibly want to employ this person because they have a bottom. No, because they posted a photo of their bum while drunk. Now, I mean, for God's sake, we're at a university. Who hasn't posted a photo of their bum while drunk? you are very much in the minority.
They don't believe me anyway.
I think a lot of companies are so flipping po-faced that they take themselves so too seriously. I mean, you know, I personally won't deal with agencies that do that because I don't give a monkey's whether or not someone dropped their trousers on one and posted a photo on it. You know, they've got a pair of buttons, big deal, we all have. Can they do the job? Yes. Do they have a propensity to embezzle the company they work for? I'd probably like to know that. Naked bum shots, not that important in the grand scheme of things. But of course, there is also the irony this goes the other way, and I know several recruitment agencies who, for front-end and web design roles, will not put a candidate through unless they have a profile on GitHub. Because it saves them a lot of money because they can instantly see whether or not that prospective candidate can walk the walk as well as talk the talk. You know, we're coming to grips with all of this. And on the one side, there's the dark, scary sort of stalk me, find out whether or not my teenage daughter is pregnant and give me ads for that, which Target had in the US about 6 months ago. But on the other hand, I think that, at least for me, the last three jobs I got, I didn't get through through job agencies. I got through the fact that I was verbose and gobby enough to put what I thought about certain matters on the internet, and the company said, oh, you sound like you have an opinion. Would you like to come and work for us? So it does have benefits and downs. and downsides rather on both sides. As a social group, as a society, we haven't got to grips with that. But you know what? In the grand scheme of things, we haven't got to grips with a lot of things, which is why we still have wars over absolutely bloody stupid things. So, by the way, I promise not to swear. I don't think I did too much, although I did.
Okay. Okay. I won't bother editing them this time. I'll give a very quick last one to Angus, and then we'll.
An observation and a question. First observation was on, I would have said previously, about the fact that there is no delete button. We reflect what's legal and what's not legal to do. Can somebody actually physically do it? And if there is no delete button, somebody can. Some techie type person can. If the data's still out there, somewhere tagged or deleted or whatever, somebody can. The spooks, the MI5s or whatever the world, they can do it once it's out there.
Correct. So, I mean, let's take a very, very simple example. All right, that tweet, which I showed you, that will exist in the 16 data centers that Amazon have cloud instances on, and which Twitter uses to run their service on. So that's 16 copies of that tweet immediately. That will also exist in Google's search index, and Bing's search index, and Yahoo's search index, and all and Baidu's search index. That will also exist on CDNs, the content delivery networks, which maintain intelligent caches, so that you don't have to wait 30 seconds for a web page to be fetched from the other side of the world. It geolocates itself to the CDN endpoint, which is geographically closest to you, therefore it has the shortest latency. And for Akamai, who are the largest CDN provider in the world, I think at the last count, they had in the region of 4.5 million CDN endpoints. That's not the number of servers behind that endpoint, that's the number of endpoints. And there's probably a couple of thousand servers caching behind each one of those. Yes, I am sure if somebody really, really tried hard and spent about 4 years working on that one thing, if I paid enough money, I could have that particular tweet deleted. But even while this man I've paid to go and track this down and delete it is doing it, it's proliferating again. Yeah, it's playing. You're playing whack-a-mole.
You're asking for people.
Yes, you're never going to catch up.
Well, that really leads into my question, the fact that what's the carbon footprint of all this just your profile going to be? What it is, and if it's growing exponentially, then surely there's going to come a point, possibly not too distant future, where people are actually going to be thinking about this sort of stuff.
Well, to a certain degree, they already are. I mean, one of the countries which is, one of the two countries in the world which is showing the greatest growth in data center numbers is the state of Alaska and in Iceland, simply because they have an awfully large amount of open territory, which is permanently in permafrost, therefore they can sink very large amounts of servers in very, very cold earth and not have to pay the exorbitant fees that air conditioning in the state of California, for example, needs. But I think we need to keep this in check. And yes, data centers do generate an awfully large amount of greenhouse gases. That is very, very true. But their carbon footprint is probably significantly lower than the supermarket who delivers your food to your local branch every day. So I think a sense of proportion is needed here.
I was thinking possibly the availability of power and power refugees and all that sort of stuff as well. Because there are 16 data centres, whatever it is, never. But it's also the fact that, you know, so many places, presumably the number of places it gets copied is going to increase as well, because there's going to be more service providers doing stuff, or early, whatever, as well as the volume of stuff increasing as more folk go online. Do you see it at an end point?
Oh, I think eventually it'll grow so big we'll collapse in on ourselves and form a singularity. Right. Sorry. Final extremely facetious answer. I don't think the internet is going anywhere, but bigger and bigger. And despite people's attempts to control it and regulate it, it's got a very, very good history of just ignoring those things and rooting around them. Technology is moving on extremely rapidly. We probably need another couple of wars in order to get the technological boost that wars seem to generate. So we need to kill a few more million people in order to get a more efficient battery or a more efficient electricity supply, maybe. I'm not suggesting this is going to be a good idea. But lower power consumption is growing almost in line with Moore's law of CPU power growth. And what a single machine 10 years ago would have pulled, because it needed a totally air-conditioned, water-cooled environment, you can now run two data centers on that output. So, it's getting better and more efficient and less ecologically abusive as each year goes past.
So, you don't think they're going to be efficient
then? I think if the amount of electricity that the internet consumes becomes an issue, then we'll have so much more greater issues going on that we probably won't even notice that one.
Okay, right. This is restless. It is 5:30. So after that sobering stuff, we'll probably dry it back. So it's time to plug AGI Geo Drinks, which are supposed to be taking place across in the TV at Library Bar. So I guess we will head over there now. I think Gary has to head off to the airport and taxi.
I saw what you did there.
So, I'll start with thank yous. First of all, thank you all for coming. Thanks indeed to all the volunteers for helping shove tables around and drinks in various places. And, of course, thanks indeed, much as greatly, to Gary for.